Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramhansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your blissful presence within, that everything we do be inspired and guided by your wisdom. Om peace. Amen. Let's meditate now for a few minutes. This topic is so formless. While we meditate, let's each one of us ask Divine Mother to inspire and guide us, that your questions and thoughts and our responses to each other will all prove to be profoundly beneficial and draw each one of us closer to the infinite presence within. Truth is, we could talk about just about anything. Does anyone have anything that they would like to focus on, or before I just launch out in whatever direction occurs to me? Any thoughts? Any questions at all that you ever wanted answered or discussed? Now is the moment.
I usually don't speak in these classes because I'm just an open vessel. Mm-hmm. But because I'm fresh off one of our healing evenings from last night, this is not a question, but I know there's a lot of elements in it that have to do with cultivating bliss through yogic principles, which I would distill into how do I live more from my divine self instead of my little self. And I've learned that via Master Swamiji and my teachers here. And there's so many elements. It's amazing to me when we put together our calendars here, of course, like 6 months ago, someone said, oh, if you're going to have a class, then tell us the title and the description. And something just comes to me and I have learned to trust and I send it in. And then it comes to the time when the class is going to be happening in a week and I think, okay, what's going to happen here? And then in meditation, something comes and I think, wow, Master, thanks, that's great. And then steps further, I'll come to the actual evening and I walk in and just something else happens. As anybody who teaches knows, you have to do your prep. But then it's just amazing what happens in the moment. And even just little practical things, like because it's a Friday night, often I'll walk in and there isn't an altar. So class starts in 15 minutes and I go, oh, and I just run and I gather everything and it looks beautiful. So those are all things that again, have varying principles behind them, but that I've learned here little by little. So the yogic principles behind them actually are energy, concentration, absorption, applying those things. The end.
Okay. That's a very good beginning point. Why don't I hear from others, and then we'll go back one by one. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to comment or suggest? There's a lot in what Rita said that we can talk about. Anyone else?
What are some of the challenges that come up when you try to cultivate bliss without using yogic principles? That seems like the title is a bit tricky. It almost mentions that you can cultivate bliss without yogic principles.
years ago, when this man was sort of working his way through the question of whether or not he should pay more attention to Swami Kriyananda and his advice, he summarized it like this: if you do what Swami says, it works out. If you don't, it don't. So it's sort of like trying to cultivate bliss without following yogic principles. It don't. Okay, anyone else? I can say more about that too, but...
Just a quickie question. What place do you think the eight manifestations of the divine, whichever way of saying that phrase one uses, holds in our early meditation teaching for newcomers?
Oh, that's a very good question. Okay. Anything else? The eight manifestations is the one thing that occurred to me that would provide a conversation point here. I'm going to start with some of the things that Rita said. Let me just try to think this through for just a minute here. When I was meditating, I was thinking, you know, what we ought to talk about is your fundamental attitudes and practices, which are really the whole spiritual path. I think we can also back up to the word bliss. I mean, the relatively small attendance in person to this class, I don't know what the online presence or the future presence will be, is indicative of the fact that most people don't think in terms of bliss, although it is kind of it's a slightly trendy word now. You know, follow your bliss is something that people say. I love being older. I absolutely adore being older because you can just, you watch things come and go and you have a greater sense of the temporary nature of certain things. Swami Kriyananda was a contemporary of a teacher named Stephen Gaskin, who I think has sort of faded from prominence now, but in the 70s, he was an extremely prominent teacher is the right word for him. He came out of San Francisco. He was the mentor of the hippie movement, the big hippie movement. He was a highly educated and extremely intelligent man, but he affected a rather folksy way of speaking. And he ended up, he had like Tuesday night class or Thursday night class, something in San Francisco that he did in the 70s, and he gathered a whole crowd of counterculture people, whatever the words were at the time. And when he gathered them all into a convoy of school buses, and they headed across the country and ended up in Tennessee, where they started a community called The Farm. And The Farm in Tennessee, in Ananda, and Findhorn in Scotland, and then there was something on the East Coast. Unfortunately, the name escapes me right at the moment. I'll remember, it'll pop into my head in a moment. But there were just a few really substantial communities. There were a lot of little things happening. There was something in New Mexico, a Sufi community in New Mexico. The names of these are now not coming to me. Tassajara, the Zen. There were a few around, but The Farm was a really big one. And Stephen Gaskin was a really big teacher there. Now, wait a minute, why did I bring this up? Oh, yes. And he was his whole thing was so different than Ananda. But when Swami Kriyananda met him at some gathering of leaders, so to speak, Swami was completely entranced by him, and just they really liked each other. And Stephen gave Swami some kind of major compliment that was along the lines of, it started out referring to the kind of person who comes to a pool hall and hustles and appears to be not as good as he is and then gets everybody to play with him and then wins down. Stephen's explaining that some people who purport to be wise are really just pool hall hustlers. But by contrast, Swami was not a pool hall hustler. I mean, this was just Stephen's way, and that he was the real deal, with a whole lot of slang words to explain that Kriyananda was the real deal. Swami, in a far more elegant, refined way, said exactly the same thing about Stephen, basically appearing as he does to be something other than he is. He really is an authentic, genuine, admirable, deeply devoted, very fine human being. And they had a very charming rapport from two different worlds. The reason I'm saying all of this is that Swami remarked that Stephen, who was very popular at the time, although now has virtually disappeared from the scene, and Swami Kriyananda, who was always way on the edge, he was highly respected, but he was never popular in the way that other people were popular, like Richard Alpert, Baba Ram Das, and, you know, they were popular. Swami was never popular. Swami himself said, whenever I feel myself getting caught up in any popular fad, he said, or beginning in any way to be in tune with any popular fad, he said, I immediately step back and reconsider my position. You know, if I'm accidentally getting in tune with one of these transitory things that sweep across society, and he considers 10 or 20 years to be transitory, he said, I have to stop and re-examine my principles and ask, because, to put it in a very simple way, if I'm in tune with these times, I can't possibly be in tune with what I'm really trying to present here. But by contrast, he talked about how Stephen Gaskin was perfectly in tune with the times. And now he just played it perfectly, but it was authentic. It wasn't in any way a pretense. It was just genuine who he was. He was genuinely in tune with the world in which he was living. Swami made that remark about Michael Jackson, too, when the teenagers in our community were appalled to realize that Swami had never heard of Michael Jackson and had never heard Michael Jackson. So they gave him a sample recording, whatever, in whatever form it would have been in those days. And Swami listened to it and remarked that Michael Jackson was a consummate artist, he said. He's a superb artist. He knows exactly what he wants to say, and he says it perfectly. He said, and he also said, his message is absolutely in tune with the times. This was before the other side of karma swept the man away. He's perfectly in tune with the times, and that's why he's all across the globe. He's just acclaimed. Everybody hears what he's doing, and it speaks right to where they are. And so they go with him immediately. You know, that's how people become popular, is they're in tune with the times. And Swami remarked that he himself is completely out of tune with the times, and therefore mass popularity would be an impossibility, because what Swami was working for was something that so far in the future, he's setting a cycle that just isn't going to fulfill itself for a long time. More recently, I was remembering, and I read it, Swami had said it, but it reminded me, Christianity essentially disappeared for 300 years. 300 years. That's really a long time. It wasn't that it disappeared, but it disappeared from public view. Jesus died, was resurrected. His disciples who believed in him, the disciples got together. They made plans about how they were going to carry his message out. All the disciples carried on that responsibility. They went two by two. You read in the Acts of the Apostles, which is a very interesting part of the New Testament, if you haven't read it. It just describes what they all did after Jesus died, where they went and what happened to them. And then, of course, the record kind of goes silent for a while. There's really no, after that, it's probably the Vatican has all the documents, but they're not publicly released until Constantine, who was a king, had an experience on the battlefield of the presence of Jesus, and then he declared that his whole kingdom was going to be Christian. And that was really the beginning of what we think of as Christianity, but there were three centuries in between in which it was gaining power, so that when that moment finally came, Swamiji says, on one hand, you can call that, most people think of that as the beginning. He said, in a certain sense, it was the end. It was the end of Christianity because it was the king declaring what their religion would be, which is not really conversion. That's just government saying, this is who we are. He said, devotion to Jesus had to be individual. And when it was invisible and individuals were merely inspired to embrace a teaching from their own experience, that's true. That's true spirituality. When you're simply born into it and it's the state religion, of course, it's possible in that still to find true spirituality, but merely because thousands of people and whole countries are now devoted, it doesn't in any way mean that it was more true than it than during those years when it was invisible. So what Swamiji, what Master did first, of course, well, actually, let's go all the way back. What Babaji and Christ decided would happen, which is that there would be a messenger sent to the West who would, you know, bring about this spiritual renaissance in the world through the power of Kriya Yoga. Babaji to Lahiri, Lahiri to Sri Yukteswar, Sri Yukteswar to Yogananda, Yogananda to America, Swami Kriyananda as one of the foremost among the Americans he master came, is all part of this, what you could only call is the coming in of the tide. Or you can think of more military images, which is establishing the beachhead or the first assault, you know, against the enemy of materialism. When those Indians, Yogananda being one of them, Vivekananda before Ramatirtha before him, the Vivekananda Swamis, the Ramakrishna Swamis who came after Vivekananda, you know, when they came to the West, they were, you know, in their Orthodox Hindu society, to go to a country like this was to lose your caste status, to become corrupted forever. I mean, this was not a simple thing to do. And then to be caught in this really godless pagan society that had no concept, and even just, you know, something as simple as vegetarianism, it was all really dangerous. You know, they had to be really motivated inwardly to do it. There's a movie about the Indian genius mathematician, Ramanujan, was that his name? And just what happened to him as an Orthodox Brahmin when he had to live at Cambridge. And just how he couldn't participate in any of the life there because all of it was so contrary to the Brahminical restrictions in so many ways. And okay, now all of that is to say, when we were talking about this in a different gathering, but the point is so interesting to me. And this is all about the topic of bliss. I'm getting there. We understand from the principles that Master describes, even in Autobiography of a Yogi, but all the way through, that there are these three levels of creation. There's the causal plane, there's the astral plane, and there's the physical plane. And because we're incarnated on the physical plane, and most people have absolute blinders, they just live on the physical plane, they don't have any idea of more subtle realities. It's just the majority of people just take life as it is. I remember as a child somehow knowing that what I was looking at was a facade over something deeper. I mean, I remember this was a vivid experience when I was 10. But nobody around me seemed to understand that. And I literally remember staring out the window at the man in the house over there mowing his lawn. You know, I just lived in a suburban neighborhood. The man one over across the street was mowing his lawn. And I remember just staring at him, trying to penetrate through what I knew was some kind of a veil to something. Of course, I wasn't able to. And it was supremely frustrating because nobody around me had any relationship to that. I mean, if I had been born in India, there were even, regardless of how materialistic my family might have been, and my family wasn't materialistic in the sense of gross in their desires, but they were materialistic in their concept of the world. Just that they took the world as they saw it. At least somebody would have affirmed what I was saying. But in the West, especially in El Paso, Texas, where I grew up, it was not common knowledge. Let's say nobody had ever heard of it. But once you begin to understand these more subtle ways, how does spirit manifest in the physical world? They talk about these three levels. You know, it's like many of these spiritual principles have been in my world for the last 50 years almost. And then every so often you turn towards something and the implications of it begin to strike you, which is a part of how you cultivate bliss. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But the implications of causal, astral, physical, I've really begun to see it in a very different way. And it's related to the fact that Christianity disappeared for 300 years. On the causal plane, which is the closest to spirit, if you want to sort of understand this more, Autobiography of a Yogi, the chapter called Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar resurrects and appears to Master after Sri Yukteswar's passing, and he describes the fact that he is now an avatar on Hiranyaloka, which is a planet it's a causal planet, where beings who are just about to merge into God, who have no astral karma, no physical karma, I mean, I can only repeat the words. And you can read the chapter over and over, and somehow some vague intuitive part of yourself can get a glimpse of this. But he talks about just that these powerful beings are also the conduits for many of the thoughts and inspirations that gradually manifest, not just on planet Earth, but in physical worlds everywhere, because everybody has to serve. You know, nobody just lives for themselves. Part of what you do is that how you become free is that you become part of a greater reality and everything that's yours is given away. Here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey, is just to work for the redemption of everyone. So from the causal level, the great masters radiate these ideas. They are received by astral, on the astral level, whether it's manifested physical beings or astral beings, I don't know the mechanics that clearly, but thought turns into a specific plan, and then that energy is applied to that plan, and that plan manifests. And even in the microcosm of the material world, anything that's manifested on the material world starts as an idea, energy is applied, and a plan is made. And when that plan is executed, you have the manifestation. Sitting in this building, we actually have the blueprints for this building. Somebody had the idea of building this church. They put it into blueprints. Carpenters followed those blueprints. And now we sit in this church. But if no one had ever had the thought, we would never have this. So this entire material world begins as a divine thought somewhere on the causal plane. And everything that happens here gradually manifests from thought to energy to manifestation. So the power of Christianity was the increasing power of that thought acted on by more and more people until finally it had sufficient magnetism to burst forth. Now, not all thoughts are positive. In our country at this time, There has been this, on the whole planet, and America's just caught in part of that, because we see the same thing on the whole planet. There's this fight between expansive ideas and contractive ideas, between Dwapara Yuga and Kali Yuga. And we just see this fight going on. They're negative beings in the causal, astral, and physical worlds. There's light and darkness in all places. Evil people also have ideas and manifest those ideas. Evil beings, satanic forces. So we see on this planet now, both energies have been building for a long period of time of expansive thinking and contractive thinking. And there's this sort of, you know, conflict that's growing. Very interestingly, many years ago, Indian spiritual teacher named Sant Keshav Das, he left the planet maybe 20 years ago, but he came to visit Ananda several times, and one day he was there and I was serving lunch to a group of people, which included both him and Swamiji, and they started talking about, you know, Yogananda's predictions about cataclysmic events and human cataclysm as well, wars and so on. And the two of them were talking about that first the battles will take place on the causal and the astral plane. and then they will gradually manifest on the physical plane. But first, the forces of light and dark will fight there. He actually said something really interesting. He said that the light and dark forces will fight first on the... There'll be first be astral wars in which the light forces will be victorious enough to weaken the dark forces sufficiently. Then when it finally manifests on the physical plane, the dark will be defeated. Isn't that interesting? Where his perception came from, I don't know, but that was it was still just an amazing sort of thing to think about, which has been in the back of my mind all this time. That the and also how he put it, there was another way he put it. Darkness will battle itself. That was what he said. Now I have it more accurate. What I said a moment ago was wrong. It was not that light would defeat darkness, that darkness would fight with itself, and it would weaken itself, so that when finally it was darkness against light, darkness would have weakened itself. And that's what I've been thinking for decades, watching the world, is that many times you really can't tell who the good guys are, because there's just one corrupt force fighting another corrupt force, one power, greed, and selfishness fighting another power, greed, and selfishness. Sometimes it's more clear. But sometimes it's just a civil war among the darkness. But Sant Keshav Das made that statement that that would happen and that would weaken the darkness. Who knows? You know, presently some of the people in power are being betrayed by other people in power and they're all just turning on each other. You know, and so you just don't know. These are the events of today and yesterday are tiny in the cosmic scheme, but each one of these little pieces makes things happen. Now, let me just come back to where I was coming to. So I was talking about Swamiji being out of tune with fads and you know, never wanting to be in tune with this planet, but he's always been working to just get the right thoughts. And it's fascinating to me to see how effective this... I mean, the causal plane is the war of ideas. And then, of course, the astral plane, people act on it, the energetic plane. Because even if we're in the material world, we're living on all three levels simultaneously. That was the point I wanted to put in. We act from thought, energy, and manifestation all the time. So when I started on the spiritual path in 1967, which is now quite a while ago, you know, the ideas that we were embracing were so far out from mainstream society. I remember there was this man, I don't know if he's still living, he might be, his name is Michael Toms, and for a number of decades he was a leader in the Bay Area, actually, of all of this new way of thinking. He had a radio program, which may still be going, which was called New Dimensions. And in the course of time, he interviewed every expansive thinker, basically, who came anywhere near San Francisco. He was a friend of Ananda. He helped us on a number of occasions do different things. But at one point in the course of that, it was probably somewhere in the 70s, it might have been later, Time magazine put on the cover the New Age, the concept of the New Age. And Michael got on the radio that Saturday night and he said, "Hear about it tonight on New Dimensions Radio. Read about it in Time magazine 5 years from now," he said. But then, very seriously, he said, "We should be more than 5 years ahead of Time magazine," which I thought, I've always sort of remembered that. If we're only 5 years ahead, we're not really doing our job. We need to be way farther ahead. You know, we have to have the new ideas. We need to be acting on those ideas. We need to be manifesting them decades before the mainstream catches up to us, or we're not really doing our job. And so what I've watched over all these years that I've been involved is gradually what was so far out is right in the middle of society. I'll use yoga and meditation, vegetarianism, organic food, even veganism. Those are my, you know, my basics like that. Religious, a spiritual, not religious, you know, just a whole lot of... Somebody was saying something to me about we're spiritual, not religious, as if that was a new idea. No, that's just been the idea all the way along, but now it's become a common idea. Whereas when we started, you came into town and you looked for a Methodist church, and you might even look for a specific chapter of the Methodist church, and you you joined by denomination because you had a label that you followed. Now people, if they join church at all, look for the one that inspires them. And they don't care what the label is. It just doesn't matter anymore. It's energy, not form, that we're moving toward. Okay, now, just a sec, let me find my thought here again. Just give me a moment. All right. So when we start talking, and this is where I was going to come to the concept of bliss by yogic principles, which is also related to what you were saying. I think the first yogic principle that we're trying to deal with, all this was about the word bliss, so let me, all of that, believe it or not, was about the word bliss. People are looking for many different things in life, you know, and everybody defines what they're looking for in different ways. And happiness is something that people want, joy is something that people want, bliss is such a different concept, even though I was starting to say way a long time ago, which is how I got off on this tangent, that bliss has become slightly trendy. I hear people, I see it every now and then. I don't think it's mainstream by any means, but follow your bliss is what people will say. But sometimes what happens is when very elevated words enter the mainstream, then people completely lose connection with what those words actually mean. The word avatar is just been horribly corrupted to the point almost of blasphemy, that it's just assumed a meaning that it doesn't have at all. An avatar is a fully God-realized master who descends into the material plane for the salvation of others. It's not the character that you assume in a video game. It's like the meaning of that word is sacred. And of course, it's a small thing, and it's absurd for someone like me to take a stand against such trivial things. But what happens then is when you want to really talk about an avatar, you have no word anymore, because it's been co-opted, and it's been demeaned. You know, so people doing that, they must have thought it was clever when they did it. I mean, there was a movie called Avatar and so on. On one hand, you're glad that the words are being used. On the other hand, it makes you heartsick. When what I'm doing becomes mainstream, I realize it's time for me to move way over, because what I am doing is not mainstream. What I'm doing is so far from mainstream that if it doesn't show, we need to move over to make it show, which gets more difficult the more established you get. You know, when we had no form, speaking of Ananda, the only thing we had was the ideas and the consciousness. And so nobody could mistake the form for the substance. Now that we have form, people who are looking for something radical are oddly turned away by the form. And it gets very confusing, but that's what happens on the material plane. Now, coming back to the word bliss, when you reach a certain level of understanding in your spiritual life, you begin to understand that bliss is really something else. Part of the problem is that these are English words, and English words are imprecise in their meaning, whereas Sanskrit words are extremely precise in their meaning. The word Ananda, which is the name of our community, can be translated as bliss. It can be translated as joy. It can also be translated as the word God. Ananda is a word for God. God is a very strange word in English, because it has absolutely no meaning until you apply a theology to it. So when people have disputes about the nature of God and whether they believe in God, they're actually just arguing over ideas that have been imposed upon them. Many times people will have come and they'll say, well, I don't believe in God. I say, well, why don't you explain to me what you don't believe in? And then they'll tell me what they don't believe in, which is usually some theology that's been imposed upon them, which generally speaking is something really not to believe in. But we don't have the right words, because English English-speaking people were not interested in consciousness. We were interested in making the world work, which is not an unspiritual pursuit. It's just different. And the people who spoke Sanskrit were interested in understanding consciousness. So they had hundreds of words for the word God, for example, each one of which had a slight nuance of implication based on your actual experience. And that's the real difference. In the West, a lot of theology is just intellectual ideas. In the ideal of the Eastern teaching, it's all about your experience. So you can say a word like joy, or you can say a word like bliss, and people will still impose upon that word the narrowness or expansiveness of their own experience, but at least we'll be talking about something that we all can attach ourselves to in something that has to do with my authentic reality, not just my ideas about reality. So the word bliss is an elevated word from joy, and the word joy is an elevated word from the word happy, even though happy, joy, bliss could all sound the same. And the problem with the very popular idea, follow your bliss, is depending on what you define bliss to be, how you even perceive whether you're having it, because the difficulty is, in the material world, we tend to experience life, we do experience life from the perspective of the ego. And we experience life so steadily and completely from the perspective of the ego that we don't even know it's a perspective. We just think it's reality. The infinite self, the jiva, which is the spark of divinity, becomes identified with limitation. And whether that limitation is identified as a causal being, as an astral being, or as a physical being, we're identified on all three levels. You can gradually shed your physical, material identification, your astral identification. Sri Yukteswar was working on the level where jivas, individual beings, had transcended both astral and physical planes, and all they were working with was this very thin veil of separation from the infinite. Again, these are words to me, but I can intuit what they mean. Perhaps you can also. But the ego identifies with limitation, and then it begins to perceive its well-being and its self-interest in terms of that limitation. So almost everyone who lives on a material plane, to some extent, and many people completely, just identify with the body that they've incarnated in. And what that brings with it is the whole story of the family I was born into, the way I was raised, what happened between me and my siblings, my parents. And the person may even identify to the extent of, you know, my heritage, my grandparents. You know, and there's lots of theories about who you are now based on who your family used to be. Relatives that you never met. Ancestors is what I mean by that. In the path, Swamiji puts very profound ideas sometimes in just a few sentences, and I'll remember these incredibly interesting things he said, and you know, I'll think about them and speak about them, and then I'll go back in the book and realize it's half of one paragraph, that he got the whole idea into two sentences, and this was one of them. He spends some time in his autobiography, The Path, talking about the family from which he came from a generation or two back. You know, they were Welsh and they were English, and I can't even remember, his grandparents or his great-grandparents helped settle the Oklahoma Territory. They were pioneers. His father, as he described him, was a pioneer of a different sort. His father was an oil geologist who basically worked internationally, which in the 1920s and 30s was not nearly as common as it is now. I mean, you couldn't even fly across the world. You had to take a ship. And so his father was stationed in Romania. And they only came back to America every 2 or 3 years. And then they had to, you know, it was a month-long voyage on a ship and so on. So it was really something to separate. But his father was that kind of pioneer, is how he described him. And then in one sentence or two, Swamiji says, I describe my antecedents, the family from which I came. He said, not because they defined me. He says, in this sentence, I believe is exactly how he said it, I came into this world fully myself. He said, I'm explaining this because I'm describing the characteristics with which I chose to associate. Which I think is a fascinating way to put it, isn't it? And you can read that Swami Kriyananda came into this world fully myself. But the fact is, all of us come into this world fully ourselves. And we are describing the forces with which we choose to associate, because those are the appropriate forces for us to work out the karma, whatever karma that might be. And this is where the law of karma becomes extremely challenging if one has chosen to associate him or herself with very difficult circumstances. If you've chosen to be abused, if you've chosen to be involved with evil people, if you've chosen a life of suffering or sacrifice, it's a huge spiritual challenge to see that as part of a cosmic plan in which you participated, in which it was not imposed upon you, but that your own karma drew you to that. And I never ask anyone to embrace that until they're ready. I mean, I chose to associate with very supportive and positive circumstances, so it's easy for me to say it. But when somebody tells me that they had alcoholic parents, that they were abused as a child, that they're refugees from war, you know, just all the things that really happen to children, I mean, naturally a person doesn't want to say, I chose this. It takes time, a very long time, before everything aligns sufficiently for one to be able to feel that is true. But the problem with the law of karma is it's either always true or it's never true. And so it's just a challenge that you just have to put on the shelf if it's too much at this point. But Swami choosing to associate, all of us choosing to associate with those forces, you know, set us on a, and this is where I was talking about, we identify with limitation. And because we identify with the body, Master said ego is the soul identified, he said, with the body, but body means physical, astral, and causal, meaning with limitation. Once we identify with limitation, we tend to feel that our state of consciousness is influenced by the conditions in which we live. And we believe that because we have identified with it. If you don't identify with it, it happens, but it doesn't really happen to you. I mean, you can see things that are happening at a distance. You can see them. You can even feel sympathy for them, but they're not happening to you. Master has this amazingly challenging phrase, people make a mistake of thinking that everything that happens to them concerns them personally. And I can still say that, and I still, my mind just tilts. Of course it concerns me personally if it happens to me, but that's only because I identify with it. Swami Kriyananda so succinctly described what it is to live your life but not identify with it. He said, I consider Swami Kriyananda an event for which I am responsible. Which means that you have to participate. It's your responsibility. I think of it like, in the course of my life, I have been responsible for many large events. When I first came to Ananda, I started cooking in what was then the only retreat we had. It's now the seclusion retreat. I started cooking in that kitchen, which involved cooking for Christmas and then for spiritual renewal week. Gradually, this Indian banquet developed, and I started cooking for that banquet. Even after I stopped being the main cook on an everyday basis, every spiritual renewal week for quite a number of years, I would still cook that banquet, you know. And it got bigger and bigger, 100, 200, 300 people. And myself and my little crew, we would just go in there and make it. And, you know, it's no small thing to cook a large, complicated meal for that many people. And I have to plan a lot in advance.
I'd have to do all the shopping. I had to get the recipes, and I called it my brain, and I would print out my brain, and I would tape it to the refrigerator, because in the course of managing 20 or 25 people, every so often my little mantra would be, I would just sort of stop, and I'd say, okay, where am I, and what am I doing? And then I'd walk over, and I'd read my brain, and I would see where I was supposed to be, and we'd see what was going on. Now, I was about as engaged in that project as a person could be, because without the full concentration of will, it never would have been served on time, and it would have been terrible. I mean, I had to watch it all the way through. We had these big 8-gallon square pots. They still use them. We called them coffins because they were shaped like coffins. So we had these coffins that we would cook, and I would cook. I love to make kheer, which is Indian pudding where you cook milk and rice and sugar, and you cook it for a long time, and it just gets denser and denser. And the best way to make it is to pretty much stir it continuously. Of course, if you're making it in a 1-quart saucepan, the whole thing is done in 30 minutes. But to make a full coffin, 8-gallon coffin full of kheer, it literally took all day. And so part of the job was that I had to assign people, and they had to stir it continuously, because if they didn't, it wouldn't work. In the first 2 or 3 hours, it was really appeared to everyone doing it to be a completely worthless job. But I knew if they kept doing it, that at the end of 8 hours, it would be perfect, which it was. It still is one of my absolute favorite things in the whole world, but I can't always get people to stir for 8 hours. The point being, there was commitment. You know, I had the idea in my mind that this is how it was going to be made. We had to apply energy to it. Somebody had to stand there and stir that without stopping, because the milk would burn otherwise and the whole pot would be ruined. I mean, because that what would happen, you know, one tiny scorch and it's finished. Absolute commitment. But never for a moment did I think that I was that Indian banquet. I mean, I knew who I was, and I knew that I was doing this. Now, when Swami Kriyananda says, I am an event, Kriyananda is an event for which I am responsible. And you see him, he was so committed. I mean, he was committed to the point of annoyance. He was annoyingly committed. He would decide that this book was going to be done on this date, this music was going to be done on this date, he was going to go on this trip, he was going to do this, and his health he would have trouble with his health, there would be challenges with the money. And many times, too many times, I tried to talk him out of keeping his commitment. And, you know, he became quite annoyed with me on many of those occasions. Once we were traveling together, and we arrived where we arrived, and he was so unwell, and we were supposed to drive 4 hours to another place the next day. I said, you can't. I said, you just can't. You have to call them and tell them that we're not coming. And I said, they won't mind. He said, they might not mind, but I do, he said. I've given my word. He was getting a little impatient with me. And then he said, my life is to serve Master. I don't care whether I live or die. He said, this is what my life is for. I said, I care whether you live or die. And he says, oh, I understand that. And, you know, and then the conversation got a little better. But he said, but, you know, how can you be my... And then I said, how can I'm not being your friend if I don't support you in what you yourself are committed to doing. I'll go back to my Indian banquet, which is laughable by comparison to what I'm just telling you. But I used to work with the same group of women. We were all the nuns. We used to cook together. We used to cook these banquets together. Fortunately, most of them didn't know how to cook, which was actually more helpful, because then they would just do what I would say. But every so often, and you know, the way I did it, I just needed them to do what I had to say. But every so often, there was someone in there who was really good, and then I could turn things over to them. And then there were some people who just didn't like to be told what to do. So there was one woman in there who just, because of her nature, we were very good friends, but just on principle, she objected to being ordered around. And so she would just fight with me. And I remember at a certain point, I put down my spoon, and I said, I can either cook this banquet or I can fight with you. I'm quite capable of doing either, but I cannot do both. you know, and it was, I was mad, and she was mad, but it was humorous also, and, you know, the thing was dissipated, and we stopped. I mean, that's sort of what Swami was saying to me. I can either serve Master or not, and you either come along with me with what I want to do, or you just get off the ship, because, you know, I'm going where I'm going. All of this is using the word commitment. So to not identify with the limitation does not mean that you are free of the limitation. It just means that you operate within it from just this tiny step backwards. And therefore, my happiness is not conditioned by what happens in the world of limitation. Because I have not identified with that limitation, I merely operate through it. When there was some huge, there was a period of time, the same time that Ananda was going through a lot of its most terrible litigation, it was like there was a satanic wave that just that moved through all the ashrams in America. In the book that I've written about Swamiji, which I believe will be published, now my target date is April 21st, which is Swami's Moksha Day. I'm not going to make it by Christmas, which I thought, for various reasons, but that was the date Narayani suggested to me, and I think that's probably going to turn out to be the date. But in that book, I talk about the period of time when Ananda was being attacked in many of these other ashrams. Really, literally, every major teacher in every ashram in America was attacked with, you know, scandal, accusations, internal fighting, and pretty much everyone went down. Swami Kriyananda was pretty the only one who stood and fought, and Ananda was pretty much the only ashram that emerged intact. It's not that everything disappeared, although some did disappear or were diminished. I don't want to be unfair, because many of my brother and sister devotees in many other lines are still standing and are still loyal, but it was a tough time. But one man who, one very fine man who just, things got very confused in his ashram, and he basically walked away from it. He just walked away from it, let it become what it was going to be, which is, it hasn't ceased to exist, but its focus has shifted from what it was when he was leading it. But he went to another part of the country, and a very fine man basically took him in and took care of him. And that man said later, when he was watching this teacher go through it, he said, it was not so much that he was going through a hard time as that a hard time was going through him. Which I thought that was such a brilliant way to put it. Because hard times do go through us. And if we're committed to the event, we have to be committed to seeing that hard time through. So it's not like we always go through with a smile on our face. It's not like you never curl up in the fetal position on the floor and just cry until you can't cry anymore. You know, part of the commitment to this experience is that you have to feel it. We think that not to be identified with it means not to be committed to it, and therefore not to feel it. But much of the time, when people don't allow themselves to actually experience it, much of the time, it's not because they've transcended it, it's because they're afraid of it. Swami remarked about someone else, so-and-so appears to be more detached than I am. He said, but he's just less committed. Because one of the ways we protect ourselves from suffering is to not be committed. But if you're committed, you have to go through the whole thing. You have to go through the betrayal, the disappointment, and you have to feel it all the way through. But it's an event that we have to see through. If those Indian dinners crash and burn, you know, it's a serious problem. There's a commitment there that has to be kept. If my children, I don't personally have children, but if a person's children are suffering, you have to go through that. If someone that you love leaves this planet or betrays you in some way, you can't just pretend that that's not really happening, because it is really happening. And if you're committed to the life, you have to live through it. But that little bit of it being an event, not myself, is what allows you to stand back and realize this is a hard time going through me. It's going through me. I'm not going through it. But it's going through me, and we're really having this experience. When I would cook those dinners, it was many days getting up early and working late. There was no shortcut to making that happen, and there's no shortcut to living through this. And this is where the subtlety of happiness, joy, bliss, all really counts. And coming all the way back, this planet, being a very rajasic planet, very active and very, we are so rajasic. You know, we're just always, always busy. I mean, just walk out and all the cars are whizzing and everybody's doing something. And we're just a very rajasic planet. We don't sit around. The whole planet in America is a very rajasic country. But the ego's basic MO is ease and pleasure. And that's just how the ego orients itself. We want it, if it's not easy, we think of it as bad. If it's not pleasurable, we think of it as bad. Our fallback position and our definition of good is easy and pleasurable. And so when things are easy and pleasurable, we call them happy. And we say we're happy because it's easy and pleasurable. My kids are doing great. My job is working really well. My house is comfortable. You know, I managed to win the political party, got elected the one I wanted. You know, my mother-in-law went back to Minnesota. You know, whatever it might be that really makes it easy and more pleasurable for us. We call that good. But when money is tight, when the kids are in trouble, when the relationship has fallen apart, when the job is dicey, then we call that bad. And we even say that, bad karma, good karma. Because easy and pleasurable. And when we're identified with this, we want it to be easy and pleasurable. But if we're recognizing that this is an event that I have to go through and that my actual reality is something else, then we think of it very, very differently. And if that actual reality is related to self-realization and our eternal experience, then ease and pleasure is less important than bliss. Because bliss is not dependent on ease or pleasure. And that's what we're looking for. You had a question, Larry? Yeah, take the microphone. Uh-huh.
So I like these little easy phrases that remind me of what to me is truth. So I heard a speaker say, I think he saw a bumper sticker, that I am not my story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just added a line to that. I am not my story, I am spirit.
Oh,
and that helps remind me, you know, when a hard time is going through me, that even though, you know, I have to give my full commitment to this event or this story, fundamentally that's not who I am and not what's important. What's important is that I'm spirit. You know,
and what's important is that whatever is necessary, whatever hard time necessarily must go through me, is going to ultimately free me. And no matter whether it's easy or pleasurable, what really awaits me on the other side of it is not ease and pleasure, but bliss. And even just that understanding that bliss is a victorious state. Bliss is not the state that comes to us when all obstacles are removed. Bliss is the state that comes to us when obstacles are no obstacle, because they're just something that has to be done. You know, because I have been gifted my whole life with good health and an abundance of energy, and just because of the life I've lived, I've taken on many large projects with the confidence that I can see them through. So I'll go back to Swami Kriyananda. You know, somebody made some comment at one point about the challenges he's had to face in his life or the huge accomplishments he's done. And his comment was just very interesting. It never seemed hard or large to me. In other words, it was the same size as his energy. And so it would have been pointless for him to do less. When we did a little, I say little, it didn't seem little to me, when we did this political action campaign in Nevada County, which is where Ananda is located, to get the incompetent director of the planning department removed from her job because she was an insurmountable obstacle to the development of Ananda, Swami Kriyananda recognized immediately that she was an insurmountable obstacle, and the only way we were going to succeed in developing our community was to have her fired, and a grand jury investigation had already recommended that she be fired, but the Board of Supervisors hadn't acted on it. So, I mean, there were a lot of elements were in place. But we stepped out of our little mountain ashram and just became political, actively political in this county, and eventually got her fired. And we just did things to my mind that were just outrageous. I was right in the middle of it. And afterwards, I said something to Swami about, you know, because it was, I'd never done anything like that before, and I went into it as a disciple. It was just, if you want to do this, sure, I'll go along with you. What do I care? You just sort of guide me and I'll act. And I discovered I have a certain genetic predisposition for these sort of things, for writing letters to the editor and standing up in front of the Board of Supervisors and, you know, getting signatures on a petition. It was kind of natural to me, the way I described it, carrying a little briefcase and walking shoes that click as you go down the hall, wearing shoes that click, you know. That sort of person was the person I could be. But after it was over, I said, Swami, look what we did. He went like this, tempest in a teapot, is what he said. Later, you know, he talked about being King Henry after William died in England. And, you know, he was the king of large countries. You know, to stir up a little thing in the county was just nothing to him. To me, it seemed big. To him, it seemed small because of the energy flow that we're used to. However, if God only allowed us to operate within the energy flow that is already comfortable for us, no matter how big that may be, who will we be at the end of our life? We'll be exactly the same person we were when we were born. And if we are completely materialistic in our understanding of reality and have no identity beyond the physical body, which is how many people live in this world, and their point of view is, just make myself as comfortable as I can, take whatever I want if I can get it, and if I can die still holding it, that's a victory. And that basically is the philosophy of our country right now, which is one of the reasons we have all the politicians we have. We have become committed to the idea, if I can get it for myself and hold on to it, why shouldn't I get it? Because there's no identification with anything greater than the limitation I'm living in, and I want to please it. And no greater reality, no karma, no nothing. And, you know, this is what the whole planet has been building to for a long time, and so now we see it really happening. But when we step out of that, you have to have reincarnation, you have to have karma. Because without those, the other point of view makes perfect sense. But without those, you might manage, if your karma is good, I mean, if forces are aligned, you might be happy, even happy for a while. But bliss is something else, because happy depends on conditions matching your preferences. Bliss is your natural state, your natural divine state that comes to you when your state of consciousness is not dependent on the limiting conditions in which you find yourself. So earlier on, someone asked, how can you cultivate bliss without yogic principles? The answer is, you can't. You can manage to sneak through an incarnation every once in a while, but even that, Swamiji just commented, he said, it just all depends on your past karma. If you set yourself up by doing the right things enough, then you might have smooth sailing. But you know, right now, in our country, in our world, we're just watching lots of powerful, successful, famous people. Just, you know, their karma's catching up with them. And somebody who was at the top is now at the bottom. It's just, and it's so common. But when we get our own world set up with pleasure and ease, we imagine that we are the exception and that my world is going to stay. All right, let's take a break and then we'll come back again. We had lots of conversation during the break about the various modern ways to make kheer. From pressure cookers to evaporated milk, and concluded, my conclusion, was that it wasn't really the cooking, it was the vibrations that we put into it. And having some poor soul stir that pot for 8 hours, which was an intensely boring job, forced them to chant and do mantras and so on, and that's what people were tasting afterwards. Now we have a comment on this side. Yeah.
Does anyone ever have to deal with resistance?
Everybody's laughing.
Where does the resistance come from? The caudal or the, I mean,
oh,
as long as...
No, go ahead. Finish your thought. Is that the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, where is that coming from? You know, I believe I want to be here. I must want to be here because I keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something in me that I would like to...
Purge.
Yes. It's a resistance.
Of course it's resistance. Otherwise we'd all be free. Otherwise we'd just hear about the spiritual path. And I mean, this is the whole... I mean, it's in the Bhagavad Gita. What is it that impels us seemingly against our... We know what is the right thing, and seemingly against our own will, we are compelled to do things that are misery-producing rather than happiness-producing. Every scripture talks about it. They tend to, not always, but they talk about it as Maya. They talk about it as Satan. There's just many forces. See, it's... So the question of resistance, let me, because, you know, how to cultivate bliss, oh, just be blissful. It's very annoying to me when people say things like that, because it's not so easy. So here's what we're dealing with. Let me think about this for a minute. The actual long metaphysical explanation of it has to do with the chakras, with the energy pattern that we build up in the mechanics of resistance. You understand the mechanics by understanding what the chakras are, how the actions, how the fact that the ego identifies with limitation creates vibrations, habitual vibrations of consciousness, which become vrittis of energy in the chakras, which represent different levels of perception of reality, how those vrittis are carried on from one incarnation to another, how those vrittis define our karma, how our responses to life are based on those vrittis. As you can see, it's a long story. For those who end up watching this online later, I have a 4-part series on the chakras, which I highly recommend it. If you're looking at my YouTube channel and looking at this, you can type in the word karma, reincarnation, chakras, and you'll find a whole bunch of other classes, because in the hour and a half we have left here, I can't explain all of this in detail. However, this is how we gradually realize we are an energy pattern, and our response, our karma, is the magnetic field created by the energy pattern that I am. And that energy pattern is created moment by moment by my responses to the event for which I am responsible, measured on a spectrum from complete commitment to my separate reality as a material being and my understanding that I am part of infinity and I recognize myself as one with God. If you think of that as a spectrum of possibilities, because it's not either or. It's like sometimes we're very generous. Sometimes we're very elevated. Sometimes we're very selfish. Sometimes we're very afraid. Sometimes we identify greatly with our spiritual selves. Sometimes we're frantic to preserve our bodies. Sometimes we're very ego-sacrificing, self-sacrificing. Sometimes we just draw the tightest little circle around ourselves. And in the course of an hour, you can vary greatly. What to speak of a lifetime or a year or multiple incarnations. But because we identify with what happens to us, those vibrations, and each, if you think of this spectrum as like the if you think of a piano, and a piano, each note has a specific vibration that has a number that can be identified. On this spectrum from complete delusion to complete self-realization, every gradation of identification with limitation or lack of, or freedom from that identification, you might say it has a number. And every thought, every response, every reaction that we have to life reflects some perception of reality and some perception of where my happiness comes from and what causes me suffering. And it just falls somewhere on there according to who we are and how far we have expanded our awareness. But because we identify each one of those actions creates a certain commitment of energy, and that commitment of energy registers in the chakras because the chakras represent the spectrum, and it creates a vortex of energy. And when the physical body dies, we go into the realm of energy, and that's the astral body, and it vibrates there exactly according to what it was in the material plane. The laws are a little different there, but the vibration is the same. And then when those vibrations that require a material incarnation become too insistent, we find ourselves reincarnated, drawn to where we are. So each of those vrittis of energy, those habitual ways of responding, when something happens, those vrittis are magnetic pools. They're whirlpools of energy. So the thought comes, oh, my mother is dying. And there's a whole series of habitual responses to my mother dying, which could be, I've never liked the woman, I'm glad she's getting off the planet, to what will I ever do once this wonderful person leaves me. And those are habitual ideas based on the experiences we've had, the responses to it, and the energy we've stored. And it's an active force. You call it resistance, but I just call it an active force. We're not a clean slate. Something enters in, and all of these vibrating whirlpools try to grab it. And it's a magnetic relationship. If you think of a river flowing with a whole lot of whirlpools, the flow of the river toward the ocean has a certain power. The whirlpools have a certain power. And it's just a matter of the dynamic between them. And if something difficult comes to us and we have a certain amount of spiritual practice, if that spiritual practice is strong enough, then our concentration may suddenly flow to the sea. If our spiritual practice is semi-strong, it'll get drawn into whichever whirlpool is the strongest. And if I have to take care of myself, no one's ever going to take care of me, other people are no damn good, they all just betray me, I need to get in there and get what I can for myself, has been an habitual response. And the thing about the chakras, the vrittis, the karma, is it's mathematical. It's metaphysics. It's not, there's no judge thinking about you. There's no corrupt politicians. It's just mathematics. And so whatever you are, is what happens. And every time we continue to reaffirm the same reality, it just gets stronger. It's pennies in a jar, and the jar gets fuller and fuller. Even if we resist that reality, then we get to put half a penny in a higher reality, and only half a penny goes into this one. If we do Kriya, or some kind of meditation that greatly strengthens the flow of the river toward the sea, then we get more and more powerful not only to resist those whirlpools, but if the flow of the river is strong enough, whirlpools get absorbed into the river and literally disappear. So what happens to everyone on the spiritual path, if they're sincere in practice at all, is that things will happen to you in your life, and you realize that you, just without even any thought, respond differently. What used to really upset you simply doesn't. You know, what used to frighten you doesn't frighten you anymore, because the power of the ocean, of the river flowing to the sea, has become strong enough that whirlpools you didn't even know were there were dissolved without your even knowing it, until something happens and you say, wow, I sure handled that well. I'm going to come back to what Rita was saying at the very beginning when she was talking about, you know, planning these programs and having intuition at the moment of what to do, coming in and finding out that I know what to do. Now, posited against it is great anxiety, not being able to make a decision, just concerned about all the choices, anxiety about arriving there and not knowing what to do, not having the confidence that I can solve this problem, because all of those are, well, to use Larry's phrase, those are the story we may have been telling ourselves for a long time. I am weak, I am small. When unexpected things happen, I can't handle it. I need to be physically strong in order to succeed. I'm crippled because of what happened to me when I was a child. These are all responses on the spectrum between God realization and complete materialism. And every single time we make one of those responses, it just goes wherever it belongs. And when we work, doing meditation, doing right things, we create new whirlpools of a more elevated kind, and we increase the flow of the river. So that this new whirlpool takes our attention a lot. Oh, I have to be worried. I just don't know what's going to happen. Actually, I don't. A friend of mine, I was saying this last night in a webinar, a friend of mine heard me whining about something. I was whining about something, concerned because I have had a habit, which I actually think I don't really have much anymore, of being very anxious about whether or not I can actually rise to the occasion. It's been a life pattern, and I was whining about something, and she just dismissed me by saying, oh, Asha, somehow you always get it done. And it was just very, like, a very offhanded remark. It wasn't like a concentrated, lo, I speak from the heavens. She just dismissed my whining on the basis of, why are you whining? It always works out. And it was very funny because I just sat there for a minute, and I thought, in fact, I always do, somehow. And that was the key word, because I had this idea in my mind of this systematic, careful, and I'm not. But somehow, I always managed to get it done. And from the outside, she could just see that. And all of a sudden, I took that, and there was like this new whirlpool that's been a tremendously positive part of my life. When the whirlpool of, oh, new starts, it's a lot weaker, and this one's a lot stronger. Her voice comes into my head, somehow you always get it done. I thought, yeah, that's really the truth. But you see, it happens just as simple as that. But of course, other people had said that to me before, but I've been increasing the flow of the river, and I've been accomplishing things. You know, it wasn't like, this is what you said, there's been a lot of work that finally, not 100%, but I'm going to try to claim it 100%, just tipped it. Now there's more energy flowing into the new whirlpool of somehow, and sometime I hope to get rid of somehow, but somehow is a lot better than like this. And how that happens, well, Master said, take care of the minutes and the incarnations will take care of themselves. I mean, that is a really big span. Minutes versus incarnations. Because you see, the minutes create that energy pattern. And then that energy pattern determines the incarnations. This is why, you know, I say to people of my age, for whom my father used to like to read the obituaries. It was just a habit of his from a young age. And actually, sometimes obituaries are kind of fun. They're like reading little mini biographies. The newspapers don't exist, and obituaries don't exist, but they used to. Sometimes you just read about really interesting people who did really interesting things, and if you have that kind of interest in the world. And so my father had read the obituaries, and I remember him telling to me the day when most of the people who died were younger than he was. And like what a big shift that was in his point of view, where death is no longer premature. It's just coming in its natural course of things. So you begin to think really differently about when you're 30, even though life can end at any moment, you have this thought in your mind that you have time. When you're 70, 75, or 80, I'm just 71, so I'm just at the beginning of that decade, but 70 is a big shift. 60, you're still strong. 70, no matter how you slice it, you know, you're in the latter part. However you want to think about it doesn't matter. But I realize there's no margin. There's no margin for wrong attitude. And wrong attitude is like, so I've suffered enough from the wrong attitudes I've had in this lifetime. I'd really rather not see them again. You know, so every minute of this phase of life is really important. It would have been nice to work on it more earlier, but at least now, what really matters? What do I really want to carry forward? And of course, as myself, a serious sadhaka for all my life, all my adult life, it's not like this is a new idea. But there is a certain freedom that if I have another body, which I have always presumed that I will, I hope to have from the age of one, where I'm not quite so identified with the experience I'm having, and I can just calculate it in terms of an event and keep the event running as it's supposed to run. You know, that's what we're really working for, because that's where bliss comes from. Bliss comes from identifying with our own greater reality. And we get glimpses of this, or we have some intuitive recognition of it. We have some experience. Everybody comes to it in some way or another, which is to a certain extent how I would characterize myself. We have the good fortune to have faith in a great master or a great spiritual person in our lives. And we realize that they're telling us the truth. And we see in their expression of life a potential for myself. And even if I don't myself actually know what that potential is, I've seen it manifested. When Swami Kriyananda said something extremely interesting, he was talking about on many levels, but he was talking about his relationship to master and this inclination of disciples to say, well, you know, so such and so, I need a perfect master, or so and so is not a perfect teacher. They use the word perfect. Swami said, how can you tell if the master is behaving perfectly when you don't even really know what his intentions are? He talked about his life with master. He said, often master was doing something that I couldn't even imagine. I certainly know when I was living with Swami Kriyananda that he often had an intention that was so different from what I thought. This is the way I put it. I viewed the life around me, the people around me, like on within the borders of a television screen. And, you know, I've been on television shows from time to time. After we published the Ananda Cookbook way back in the early 80s, Simply Vegetarian, which is still a great cookbook, it coincided with my being on this lecture tour from Seattle to Houston over a 3-month period. And so during that period of time, I did a lot of television shows for the cookbook. We were traveling in a motorhome, and so I cooked zucchini burgers from Seattle to Houston on daytime television and talked about vegetarianism. I mean, it was memorable. Let's just put it like that. So I was accustomed to, I got used to what a television station was like. And, you know, you're in this little thing like this. And there's nowadays, it's trendy. They have a camera flash around and show you that you're in a television station. So they'll actually, you're watching television and then you'll see the cameras and all of that. But in those days, they never did anything like that. So you just watch this little box. You're in this little fake living room talking to some person who couldn't care less about you, is only concerned about how they look on camera. Radio is much more fun than television. Radio, the people actually related to you. On television, the people only relate to the camera. I said I felt like a talking turnip. That was how I described myself. It was just, with very few exceptions, I was just an entity. I was a foil for their profile. But anyway, there I was. And so the people at home would see this, but when you're there, you're seeing this huge reality going on around you. And the image, when I got familiar with it, really explained, I would see that what the cameras were revealing to me, which is to say what my consciousness could encompass. So I would see what Swami was doing when he entered my frame and when he left my frame. And if it didn't make sense to me in that frame, sometimes I would have a critical or a judgmental attitude toward what he'd done. And sometimes I wasn't wrong. You know, within my frame, I was perceiving. But I realized his response started so far out the frame, outside the frame, and was focused on the other side of the frame, too. You know, his relationship with most of us was incarnations old. And he was just picking it up at a certain point while it showed. I remember once this man, the choir director for Christmas, he did a whole Christmas program and didn't include even one of Swami's songs. It was a big scandalous year. And Swami said, it's a bit awkward because I'm the composer, but it's not appropriate that we should have a whole program that doesn't include any of my music. He was a classical musician and so on. And Swami actually spoke extremely strong to him in public, which usually Swami didn't do. It was a very unusual thing. He really almost excoriated is almost the word. Because, you know, there were a lot of things going on there. And then somebody else took up the defense of the choir director and wrote Swami this long letter, you know, how inappropriate you behaved and so on. This was an extreme example. This, like, didn't happen usually. Swami's response to his critic, he wrote back and he said, in order to explain to you why I responded as I did, I would have to tell you more about that choir director than you have any right to know. Which was, again, a very uncharacteristic response from Swami because he didn't usually claim information that others didn't have access to. Usually he was very reasonable. But I thought, well, that was a very interesting response. And I was already pretty tuned in. But, you know, there was just often a lot going on that we weren't tuned into. Now, how did I get there? Where was I that got me all into all of that? I think I was talking about bliss independent of conditions. Oh, yes, how we become to believe in it because we have relationship or we have faith in someone. Perfect. It was perfection. He said, how could I gauge whether Master had behaved perfectly when I didn't even know what he was trying to accomplish? So this man thought you shouldn't embarrass this guy in public, but he didn't have any idea what Swami was trying to accomplish. He had no idea, and he didn't have trust that Swami did know what he was doing, and that trust has to come from your own experience. Swami never demanded it of us, and as I said, that was a very unusual case. The whole cycle was a very unusual case. For me, I would always say, wow, isn't that interesting? And I would reverse engineer things. Given that he behaved that way, you know, what do I think might actually be happening? And often, not in that particular case, but often I could ask Swami and he would explain himself to me, which was very helpful, of course. Once I saw him behave very, almost rudely to this woman. And afterwards he volunteered, he said to me, essentially, she was holding some very wrong attitudes and I understood what he was talking about. He said, and I sat down to see if she was still in that state of mind. And even though there was nothing explicit said, in a matter of 30 seconds, he could read her thoughts and realize that there was no point. And he just got up and walked away. In another circumstance, this woman told me, most of the times people would project upon Swamiji attitudes and feelings that weren't really his. And because I often answered letters and had to counsel, often I would say, I promise you that didn't really happen. I know that Swamiji was not actually thinking you are a terrible person. You know, it just didn't happen. And he would get these letters and he would just, you know, like, oh dear, can you please go talk to them and tell them, no, that remark in the middle of my class was not specifically directed at them. I had no idea. But this woman claimed that Swami was walking right toward her and then just looked at her and then just made a right turn and walked away. Like this. So at first I thought, something in me said, I think I better investigate this. It turned out she had a very critical attitude towards Swami. It was during the litigation years and it was, you know, people were just having to sort it out. He'd been away for months. He had just come back. It was a big reception to greet him. He walks in and she didn't have her arms folded, but her attitude toward him was, prove to me that you're not scum. And so he's walking up to greet her, and what she's saying to him is, prove to me that you're not scum. And inwardly he thought, why should I? And he just went like that. I mean, it happened exactly. So I said to her, what were you thinking? She told me what she was thinking. I said, can you ever intuit what people are thinking? If somebody's sitting there with a terrible negative thought to you, can you feel it? She said, sure. I said, you think he didn't feel it? Like, why should he? His hundreds of people are eager to see him. And you're saying, prove to me you're not scum. He says, why should I? You know, I don't need to prove to you. You can make your own decision. So he just walked away like that. So that's the word perfection, but here's the point of it. Swami said, I followed Master because he inspired me. And I really thought about that for a long time, and I wished that I had had that concept 40 years ago, because I could have been so helpful to people. Because it's not a question of measuring people, it's a question of whether they inspire you. And people can inspire you because they've had so much trouble in their life, and the power with which they respond to it is such an inspiration. Isn't that so? People don't have to be perfect to inspire you. They don't have to have no troubles to inspire you. They inspire you because of the way they respond. And you see how much more useful that is? Because if you just have somebody who's perfect and nothing ever happens to them and they never have to behave in any way that you have to behave, then you say, well, now they're worthy to guide me. But how can you ever learn anything from them if they're not in a position to inspire you to move in the same way? And one of the things that the movie Awake has actually brought into people's awareness much more about Master's life, about Paramhansa Yogananda's life. Just the fact that it did not come effortlessly to him, meaning that many hard times passed through him, and he had to be fierce and strong and go forward against great obstacles and great betrayal and huge financial difficulties and enormous personal resistance. He said, in India, he said, the guru and the ashram are supported by the devotees. He said, in America, I have to support the ashram and the devotees. And, you know, so he had to devote enormous amounts of his time and energy just to earning money. Because that was just, there was no system in this country. Where he said, when he went to India in 1935, he said people were begging him to stay there and pouring rupees into his lap. You know, it would have been effortless. Everything would have been done for him. Instead, he had to come back to America. After Dhirananda betrayed him, after all the money he'd earned was taken away, I mean, other people took it from him, and he was there he was with all the disciples and the ashram to support, and all his work had been wiped out. Somewhere in some periodical of SRF, it said Master was on vacation in Mexico. Master didn't go on vacation to Mexico. Master fled to Mexico and was not sure he was ever coming back. Mexico felt more like India, and he liked it there. And he just went there, and didn't know if he was ever coming back. He just had it with the whole thing. And eventually Divine Mother persuaded him back, and he basically said to the devotees, the true devotees, except for you, I never would have come back. You know, and that's inspiring. You know, it's perfect in certain ways, but perfect isn't even the right word. That's inspiring. My life with Swami Kriyananda, he was so inspiring. Not because he never struggled, but because he faced into whatever he had to do, and what he did is he pulled down the principles according to the spiritual principles, according to the spiritual truth. His faith in the path of self-realization, in the path of discipleship to Master, in the process of Kriya, in the law of karma, in the chakras, in reincarnation, his consistent faith in the face of enormous challenges made me realize that just this has to be true. And the fruit that I would see manifested in this world, manifested in his power, manifested in his inspiration, that's what I want to be. That was my first thought when I saw Swami Kriyananda in 1969. In the first minute I saw him, he has what I want. Look at that consciousness. That's how it just came to me. You know, look at that. Look at what's possible. I already knew it in theory, but I'd never seen it. As soon as I saw it, I thought, whatever he's doing, I have to do that. And then you do. And then gradually, it's not that you get happy all the time, because this is a hard climb. You know, this is a very steep mountain. I used to really love to read those mountain climbing stories, the Everest stories, Annapurna, you know, just incredible stories. I don't know why, of these freezing people staggering up these hills, losing their toes, you know, just craziness. And of course, the thought would cross my mind, why? Why are they doing that? But just the fact that they would do that just really, I mean, I have zero interest in mountain climbing, but they were just stories of extraordinary perseverance against obstacles and an absolute commitment to what they were doing. And so it translates into the spiritual life. And that's why you have to have the word bliss, because if you just have the word happiness or even the word joy, not every day is a good day. But there's another level. And again, you have to understand, it's not that you're always living in that level. But if you're climbing Mount Everest, that you know that the top is there. And even if you're lost in the fog, and even if you're going down before you're going to go up again, you know that the top of the mountain is there. And whatever it is, it's worth it to you to get there for whatever you think it's going to give you, regardless of whether it's true or not. In that context, it motivates you to heroic measures way beyond yourself because you know it's up there. And so when these masters constantly talk to us about bliss, it's really important to understand it's not like we're always going to be in that state. But if one becomes persuaded, and that persuasion is extremely personal and very deeply internal, but there just becomes a point where you can't get away from it. When we would travel to India on the pilgrimage tours that we started in 1986 and did for 20 years, for most of the people at that time, that was Ananda. We started in 1986, and Ananda didn't have centers in India until 2003. And when we started in 86, almost all of the 30 or so people would take were American. Sometimes a few Europeans or people from Latin America would come. Almost all were Americans. Almost all had never been to India. Almost all had never even been to, well, we called it the third world at that point, the developing world. It was just a total, complete revelation. And almost everyone who went had lots of Indian samskars and lots of romantic ideas that India allowed people to play out. And so we would just play them out. And we had some, you know, the very first trip, we went to Varanasi on the eclipse of the full moon, and which was an inauspicious event, but it was also a good time to step into the Ganges. And so the full moon was like, we were on the river close to midnight. I think the full moon came at 10 p.m. It was the first time in India. And we get on these boats, and later, they wouldn't let you go out on the river at night, but at that point, they did. So all these people who've never been to India before are floating down the middle of the Ganges in Varanasi, looking over at these ancient buildings, thousands of people lined up, waiting for the auspicious moment to bathe. It was, and that there's the moon up here, and then there's the burning god over here. It was quite an experience. Plus, people were away from their regular activities. We were meditating and chanting together. It was glorious. It's the only word for it, going to all these holy places. So then we went out for 28 days. So day 25, 26, 27, people start getting really nervous because they have to go home. And what's going to happen? And then I learned very quickly, I already knew this because of seclusions, but I explained to people, you know, re-entry is tricky. And within a week, this whole trip is just going to be a dream, and you're going to find yourself back exactly where you were, and you're probably going to feel horrible, and you're going to wonder what the whole thing was about. So this image was the image that we always told people. Deep spiritual experiences, whether it's 28 days in India or whether it's one meditation, are like radioactive substances. And you know, if radioactivity is planted within you, it just keeps radiating until the whole organism is mutated by the radiation. And so these deep spiritual experiences plant in your heart something that continues to vibrate. And even though your conscious mind may have forgotten it, this is where there's the poetic phrase, one moment in the company of a saint can be your raft over the ocean of delusion. One moment in the company of someone who can awaken within you that awareness of your potential, even if you forget, it'll just keep radiating. Edgar Cayce, who did these past life readings for people in the 40s and the 50s, he said, you were on the streets of Jerusalem and Jesus walked by and he looked at you. I mean, that would be the whole encounter. And everything that's happened to you in the 2,000 years since has been based on that, which is the gradual shifting of your awareness in relation to God consciousness. And so, you know, that's what we're doing. Somewhere or another, the concept of bliss has entered into our sphere. And the more powerfully it's entered, the more powerfully motivated we are, even if we don't know why. I remember saying to Swamiji, when early on, somewhere in the 70s, just saying to him, you know, Swamiji, my life has been so positive. You know, all my experiences are good. My upbringing is good. I have a buoyant nature. I'm cheerful by temperament. I've never suffered. I said, but I was born with this passionate desire for happiness, to have happiness and avoid suffering. I said, it just doesn't make any sense. And of course he said, past lives. Oh yeah, that's right. You know, past lives where I committed to something that was really a delusion, and eventually in the end I found out. And that's what happens. You just go and you fall off the cliff and you fall off the cliff, incarnation after incarnation, and gradually a thought begins to enter. Maybe I've got this a little confused. And we just, then we start doing something else. Nobody will do that. And this is watching all these corrupt people, you know, either getting their comeuppance or getting away with it. You just think, well, sooner or later, karma will catch up with them. You don't really have to worry about them because it will. And the same with us, our positive karma. Well, any comments or thoughts or questions? I need to take a breather, so. Were you moving for a reason? Just, okay. Okay.
Alertness.
Okay.
I can make a
yeah.
Just speaking of pilgrimage, I was on, I think, the last of those Indian pilgrimages you did, and my husband and I are now about to go on our second pilgrimage ever, and a friend was, you know, concerned about the expense of the money, and she, for whatever reasons in her head, said, "Oh, well, you know, you don't want to just throw away a lot of money for a photograph or so." And I don't tend to be a very strong person when faced with certain other strong people, but I just kind of froze, and I said, "You know, that pilgrimage I went on 12 years ago." Has influenced. I have felt that every day of my life since then.
Yeah.
So,
the truth.
Yes, what you're saying is validated here.
Yeah, it's absolutely the truth. I agree with you. People would say to us, because our trip was very expensive, because partly also in India at that time there wasn't much in the middle. There was like hotels where people who lived in the country were comfortable, and then there were five-star hotels for foreigners, and there wasn't a lot of middle ground. So we went at the top of the food chain, also because we realized that Americans needed to be able to feel completely comfortable. And so many Americans were so uneasy outside of a very clean, very Western-feeling atmosphere. We had to be able, at the end of a day on the streets, to take them to a hotel where they felt relaxed. So our trip was very expensive. And so people would say to us, I mean, I don't remember what very expensive was then, but it was still, in the context, a lot of money. Oh, no, it wasn't 10. Oh, no. It was, pardon me? Oh, and today also the five stars were much less expensive then because India wasn't even open to foreign corporations at that point, so they didn't have all this high expense accounts. It was a whole different world then. It was 4,000 or 5,000, but that was still a lot. Maybe it got up to 6. But the end point of it was people would talk to us about the money. And my response was really simple. One, if you have it, which I never suggest anybody go into debt, but if you have it, I said there has not been one person on this trip who's ever said it wasn't worth it, who ever said afterwards not only was it worth it, but they would have paid twice it for the experience. Because of that, it's not a material experience. A pilgrimage is a whole different thing. And, you know, I don't have to advocate for these, but they are really good. Ananda really knows how to do pilgrimage, and we do it really well. And it's life-changing. It's an investment in it's investment in your future lives, which is quite different. But it really is something because our experiences run from the causal level, which it's not. We're not just going from place to place. A whole new thought form of the potential of our incarnation is being planted in us, and it starts as a thought. After, for us, because there are pilgrimage places in America that are related to Yogananda, but none of the other gurus ever came to this country or lived in this country, Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri, or Babaji. I mean, in a sense, they could all be everywhere, but you can't go to a spot that's dedicated to them. So what happened was very interesting. We went to the Mahasamadhi Mandir, where Sri Yukteswar's body is buried, which is in Puri, in his ashram in Puri, which is still to this day my favorite place in India. We went to Master's Boyhood Home. We'd been to SRF places, but still Master's Boyhood Home was really something. And then we went to Kashmir and went to the Shankara Temple, where he had the visions of Mount Washington. Kashmir was also part of it. And Varanasi, where Lahiri lived. And in those days, you could get inside Lahiri's house, which subsequently it's been closed except for one day a year, but then we could go in. Especially Sri Yukteswar and Lahiri, and Master also. And when we came back and acted as light bearers and performed the arati, there were four of us who were light bearers who led that trip: David Praver, Durgan Vidura, and myself. And we all had the same experience. When we came back and did the Festival of Light in front of the pictures, there was a relationship with Lahiri and Sri Yukteswar that had never been there before, because we had been in their vibration in a way that we had never been able to accomplish on our own. And it was really interesting because, you know, we were all friends. And so later we just sort of talked about, just in conversation, and we all had exactly the same experience, which was, suddenly there's a living presence here that had never been here before. And when you think about the value of that and how that begins to change everything. And on those trips also, those first trips, we went to Kashmir. I think we also went to Nepal. I think in the first trip, we got on a plane and we flew over the Himalayas, which was really something. And we also went to Nepal or to Darjeeling. And we could see the high Himalayas. I think it must have been in the first trip in Nepal somewhere. But I remember just looking, and just even the concept of what those mountains meant and where people were. I could think about it, but when you're standing there, something completely other happens. I mean, this is a different kind of travel. This is not tourist travel. Now I'm going to come all the way back. Ananda Village is one of the holiest places in the world. The meditation retreat, the seclusion retreat up there is just extraordinary. So it's not like we don't have access. This temple is pretty darn good too. You know, it's like if we are receptive, we have these experiences. And if we recognize the power of vibration, the power of satsang, and open ourselves to it. It's not just a master made that classic remark. There's lots of rats and mice living in the canyon where Mount Washington is, and they're not making spiritual progress, he said. They're just there. So I'll quote Garrison Keillor, who I love, for this remark alone. He said, thinking that just sitting in church will make you a Christian is like sitting in your garage and hoping you'll become an automobile. which is about it. It's not automatic. But if there's any receptivity, then you start creating new whirlpools. And then what happens to those new whirlpools is that, well, I'll go back to Catherine's word about resistance because I didn't really answer it enough. You know, resistance is just habit. It's the habit that I'll be happier if I do this. Because as soon as we're really sick and tired of something, we stop doing it. And we may think that we're sick and tired of doing it, but if we watch ourselves keep doing it, you realize that there's a disconnect between the actual flow of my energy and what I'm thinking about my energy. Of course, thought is a beginning point. This is not a good idea. I need to stop doing it. But to observe a disconnect between what I know is good for me and what I keep doing is merely to be a part of life. It's not a sin. It's not a tragedy. It's not a condemnation. It's just reality that you're working with. We have to be committed enough to realize that this is what I'm working with. I mean, when I'm committed to those events, well, I'll go back to the cooking since I was there. When we started having to cook for larger and larger groups and it began to be harder and harder in the kitchen we had at that point, I tried to think, well, in India they cook for hundreds of people, you know, how do they do this? And I had this picture, some picture I'd seen of something that looked like almost like a garbage can, like a metal garbage can that was over an open fire. I thought, well, I can go to town and I can get some really big containers. Of course, I bought a plastic thing, which, you know, like sometimes something happens to your brain. So I bought this plastic tub, little garbage can, which looked just the right size to me, and I made all this dal, and then I was pouring it into this container. Like, the logic of the whole thing is a little obscure to me, but it somehow at the time it seemed like a good idea. So I'm pouring these 8 gallons of dal that I just finished cooking into this plastic container, and I keep noticing that it's some of it on the floor. And I'm confused because I'm pouring it very carefully. How is it on the floor? And I actually look down and it's on my feet. And of course, what was happening was that the plastic seam was opening from the bottom. It wasn't opening from the top, it was opening from the bottom. So it was like a volcano. I was pouring it in from the top, it was opening from the bottom, and it was pouring out from the bottom. So it's going down and then it's going out on the floor. I mean, this is the end of a whole day of cooking for some reason. And so I'm watching 8 gallons of, you know, just going out on the floor. So what I'm talking about is, it wasn't a question of whether I liked it or not. It was a question of what am I going to do about this? And so when we see a disconnect between what we're doing and what we want to do, we can just have a temper tantrum about it. We can get depressed about it. We can commit suicide about it. But none of those things are actually going to do anything about it. They're just going to be this big response, which will create another whirlpool, which is when I'm faced with an obstacle that I don't want to deal with, I just fold up. So I'm committed to dinner, so obviously I frantically scooped out what I could, and then I took the top layer off the floor, put it back. I didn't take the bottom layer, I just took the top layer off the floor, I put it all back. I looked around, not many people knew. Then that same meal, I had 8 gallons of eggplant curry, both these buildings are gone. But the dining room was here, and the kitchen was here. And it was all of it was so funky, does not begin to describe. But I had this old, and everything was, nobody had any money, so everything was, you know, found in junk piles. So I had some kind of a cart. So I'm pushing this cart over this very uneven floor like this, and somehow or another the cart falls. So I watch another 8 gallons of dinner just go to the floor. Yeah, this time I'm all by myself. And I just put it back. I did not scrape the floor, but I was less careful than I'd been about the doll. I just said, om, 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 and I put it back, and I just finished pushing it the rest of the way in. Yeah, because what are you supposed to do? You know, I mean, and even in the moment after the, oh my God, it was still funny. I knew it was funny, even though it was just such a mess. But, pardon me? Say again? Yes. But there you are. But why do we respond differently when it's personal? I mean, seriously. See, this is where we started. The whole problem is that we identify too closely with our limitations. Otherwise, we merely observe them. And we just say, what is real and what am I going to do about it? Swami talks a lot about, you know, it's not about forgiveness. It's not about self-acceptance. It's accepting reality. Either we accept reality or we just pretend that reality isn't there. And that if I am annoyed enough, this reality is going to change. If I'm just really mad at the garbage can, it's going to seal itself up and all the dolls going to go back inside. And that's about how sensible it is to say, I don't want to feel this way, therefore I shouldn't feel this way. Why am I not different? Why am I not different? I want to be different. I want to be different. Swami used to try to explain to me the difference between guilt and actual effort to improve. And it was very obscure to me because I'm so upset. You know, look at me. Look at all the energy I'm expending. See how upset I am. I'm so upset. But then I figured I'd done it, you know. I had just been really upset. And I couldn't tell the difference between that and actually just saying, what am I going to do about this? And it was a very long time before I realized. And that's what he said. He said, you dissipate all your energy and guilt and emotion, and you have none left to do anything about it. I mean, he just said it to me in plain English, but it just was, I don't know. Those thoughts just spun in my head for years. This was my friend saying to me, somehow you always get it done. Instead of dissipating all your energy and anxiety, just recognize, even if you're not doing it today, you'll do it tomorrow. Even if I'm not doing it this incarnation, I have another. Sometimes people get upset with me. I actually get phone calls on this. How can you say that you're not going to be liberated in this lifetime? You know, we all need to have faith and we should have faith. So I don't know, that doesn't work for me. That makes me really nervous. If I can say instead, if I don't get it right this lifetime, I'll get it right next lifetime. That relaxes me. And I don't spend as much energy being frantic. So we have to be practical with our own nature and with what we're dealing with. That makes sense? Okay, do we need a short break or do we have other things to say? Let's take a short break and then we'll come back for a little bit more. I have a few thoughts to share. In the context of encouraging, of trying to help people with re-entry at the end of our, you know, 28-day pilgrimages, I was thinking how much that cycle is really just like everything that we have to go through in life where we just don't progress in a straight line. Let's go back to climbing Mount Everest. You know, it's not just straight up like that. They have to go up and down and up and down and up and down. You're always progressing, but it doesn't always look like you're progressing. And so the most important yogic principle for understanding bliss is perseverance. I remember many years ago when I was very first getting introduced, before I discovered the principles of self-realization, the hippie crowd that I ran with was reading the I Ching. And you would throw the coins or whatever you do, and then you'd find the one that was meant for you. But almost everyone said, perseverance furthers. That was the phrase. Perseverance furthers the cause wherever you were. And it became kind of a joke in my mind. I slightly mispronounced the words just for fun, but whatever happened, perseverance furthers the cause. And one of the most important yogic principle, I really think it may actually be the most important yogic principle, is the fact that if you don't quit, you will succeed, and even if you quit, you will succeed. That our degree of suffering is entirely dependent upon our determination not to suffer, that has become so authentic that we are actually willing to face into those things that cause us to suffer. And it's a very subtle balance point in the mind because we become persuaded of false ideas. And we become persuaded of false ideas, we become proud of those ideas, we become committed to those ideas, and we're just not willing to let them go. Maybe we absorb them from our families, from something that we read, from some previous incarnation. I was raised Jewish, and there's a whole lot of things that come along with that. My particular inculcation of Judaism was a very strong commitment to intellectuality and a great deal of pride in intellectuality. And, you know, it took me decades to even realize that I had absorbed it, and it took me even longer to realize that it wasn't an absolute value. And, you know, it's just like this one little tiny idea that had become my habitual way of thinking. I was saying a few minutes earlier, it took me so long to understand the difference between guilt and self-effort, and how being guilty was not the same as actually resolving to change. I just couldn't see it. So I just had to repeat it for a very, very long time until finally the suffering that I experienced from that was less than the suffering I thought I would experience from facing into my limitation and putting out the effort to change it. And it's a very subtle, and it's the karmic balance. And once we have any idea that liberation is possible, then it's just a matter of not quitting and not feeling like any misstep is final. I mean, I remember, and you know, in the Ananda communities, it's a very strange circumstance relative to the world at large. Because once people become committed to Ananda, they generally don't go away. And therefore, all karma has to be faced and worked out. And so you can have very bad interactions with people. You can have really horrible long-term catastrophic experiences, and nobody goes away. You just keep seeing each other. You know, most of the time people change jobs, move to other cities, cut their ties. But I say to people, it's worse than marriage, you know, in the sense of you just can't get away from it. You just have to keep facing into it. And a man in our community had some very embarrassing thing happen to him, and you know, it was hard not to measure it as a personal failure, and it was also very embarrassing. And he came to me, you know, just wanting to crawl into a hole and never come out. And see, the other side of the reality of this community is that everybody's been on both sides of it. So the result is, as Swamiji once described it, it's an exceedingly charitable community. Because, you know, you're the one who crashed and burned today, but I'm going to be the one who's going to crash and burn tomorrow. As one of my friends once was very sick with a fever, and we didn't have it's not that we didn't have access to medicine, but we lived way out in the country, and town was a long ways away, and there were no doctors or pharmacies around, and plus we were very committed to natural means. So she had this high fever, and I was putting cold compresses on her, and so on. I mean, instead of just taking aspirin, I was trying to just bring the fever down, and it was pretty arduous. We were up most of the night. She thanked me for it, and I jokingly answered her to saying, I said, money in the bank is what I called it. I said, you know, you're the one who's sick today, I'm the one who's sick tomorrow. And I mean, that isn't why I did it. But what happens when you're in a close community, one of the enormous benefits of it is you do become very forgiving, because they're forgiving you today and you're forgiving them tomorrow. So when this man came to me and he was very concerned, I said, you've made some mistakes, they've been uncovered, you're right, everybody knows, you know, that you can't hide, there's no secrets in this. I said, so now one of two things can happen. You can either just go forward, and I said, Ananda is the most charitable community in the world, or you can now create a complex about your failure, and you can become afraid and frozen and closed off. And I said, and that will really be a disaster for you spiritually. I said, but if you just lift your head up, look people right in the eye, and just go out and say good morning to everyone tomorrow, I said, by the afternoon it'll be over. And to his credit, he did just exactly that. By the afternoon, it was over. It just didn't matter. Everybody crashes and burns, and we just pick up and go on. Durga had a beautiful dream once where everybody was up at Ananda Village, and it was this huge circle of people holding hands, except it wasn't really quite the physical world. And she said, we were all chanting together, and every so often she said, somebody in the circle would ascend, is how she described it. This was a dream. They would just sort of turn into light, and they would just rise up. But she said, one of the things that was so beautiful was you were not jealous of anyone who ascended, because you knew that we were all in it together, and that we would all eventually have the same fate. It was not a beautiful story. There's so many parts of that that are so lovely. We're just happy for each other. Now, one of the incredible powers of satsang, which is a powerful spiritual principle, which means fellowship with truth, but it also means fellowship with other truth seekers, is that we begin to become less afraid. And it's something that people have to learn. Not everybody can handle it, or people handle it in different degrees. I remember in my first months being at Ananda Village, I can remember where I was standing in that same passageway where I poured the 8 gallons of eggplant curry, because I was working in that kitchen, but I was somehow in that passageway. There was some kind of a bulletin board, and there was something on the bulletin board. And as I stood there, I was conscious of how much I knew about everybody's life, either because someone told me, because it's a big family, and if you have lots of brothers and sisters, you tell each other the news. That's not gossip. You just tell each other the news. And I was also aware of the fact that I had very strong intuition, and many of my brothers and sisters at Ananda had very strong intuition. So even what wasn't told to me, I often knew, just because I knew. And so I suddenly realized that I had entered into a place in which there was no place for me to hide, which had never been true in my life. I'd kept myself aloof my whole life because I couldn't relate, really. I mean, I seemed to function, but I never wanted to open myself to the world around me, so I was very good at. And all of a sudden, I was in a place where I couldn't be, and I actually didn't want to be. But I can, and I can still find it. I felt this incredible nervousness in my heart at being exposed. And I remember standing there saying, either you accept this completely or you'll never be able to live here. And I remember just making a decision to just let it be. Now, what the power of satsang is that you practice with people you trust, but the same secretiveness can become a habit with God. And so we begin to think that if I fail, God must be judging me the way I'm judging myself. And people project upon their concept of divinity all of their own worst qualities. And this is one of those things where people come in and they say they don't believe in God, and I ask them, what God don't you believe in? And the God they don't believe in is the one that looks a lot like them. You know, the one that's judgmental and unforgiving and unrealistic and demanding and harsh and so on. And that's who we imagine. So we have to, one way or another, move away from. That's why Swamiji said one of the most important things that a master and Ananda have to bring is God as Divine Mother. And you know, Jesus, the Jews at the time of Jesus had God as the judge. This is the law. You follow the law, you will be judged fairly. You can depend on God to judge you fairly if you follow the law. And that was what Judaism had devolved into from a very different reality. So Jesus came, and he was able to move it to God the Father. And that was why he, because, you know, the teaching of the masters is always the same, but they have to phrase it in a way that to suit the times and to suit the people they're teaching. So Jesus could move it from the judge to the Father. If you ask your father for a loaf of bread, will he give you a stone? Will he say to you, I know you're hungry, but you didn't put away the dishes for your mother yesterday, so you're not going to eat for the next 5 days? I mean, this is not a loving image of a father. Would your father condemn you eternally to hell? So he got to be the Son and the Father. The Father is still a little impersonal, and there's still, you have to meet the standard. That's the masculine side. So then Master comes, and he goes from the Father to the Mother. And there's this wonderful tape where he says, worship God as Mother. You hear his voice say, the Mother is much closer than the Father. And these are just human images that we know. The Mother is closer than the Father. The Father is essential, and there is a karmic law that you have to meet, but the Mother still forgives you. In the way the Catholics have it now, is you ask Mary to intercede with Jesus. And it's a whole theology they built up where Mary intercedes because Mary is a mother. You see, it's exactly the same teaching, but they have to put it like that. So the poor Protestants who lost Mary and all of that, they lost that whole. They totally lost the mother side of God because Mary was the one who held that. Mary would protect you, or the saints would intercede. But the Protestants took all that away and they lost it all because they didn't know what they were losing. So Master brought it back, Divine Mother, which is compassion. Jesus had it too. Jesus called it the Comforter, which is such a glorious phrase. After I am gone, God will send the Comforter. And I love that phrase. Of course, there's that wonderful little joke where the child comes home and says to Mother after Sunday school, don't worry, Mother, God is going to send the quilt. And so the mother says, that's wonderful, and then calls the Sunday school teacher. And the teacher taught that God will send the Comforter. So she figured it out. The quilt is coming. We don't have a problem. But Comforter, think about what that means. And think about what it would mean, what it does mean, if our conception of God is the Comforter. And so then we think about what the ideal mother is, whether you had it physically in your life or not. What is the ideal mother? What is ideal mother love? She's just always there. She creates you out of her own body, and she feeds you through her own self. And if that's where we always go back to, that's bliss. It doesn't mean that the war doesn't rage around you, but it means that you can always crawl onto the lap of the Comforter. And that's what Master was able to do, because we've gone through, and see, the whole, cosmically, this whole rebellion against patriarch and the necessity to assert the feminine, the feminine, is actually what's trying to happen. It's getting totally warped. So it's become a war between women and men, which is the most horrible aberration of what's trying to happen, or that women are trying to assert themselves by being more male than men. But what's really trying to happen is the feminine principle, which is compassion, forgiveness, human values, is trying to balance the masculine. Not overtake, but simply balance. Recently, and I wasn't reading the news during this period of time, so I only got glimpses, just got tiny bits of this. There was some hoo-ha here in Silicon Valley because some Google executive wrote something about how women are not going to be as successful as men, or can't be as successful as men, or something like that. And the only part of it that I know, and I don't really care about the rest of it, was that he said, women are more naturally inclined to think in terms of a balanced life, family life, and relationships. And therefore, they can't really be promoted in our company. And then women got real upset over that accusation. And I thought, what? Of course, women, that's the whole point. That is the whole point. That's what Divine Mother is, and that's what's trying to happen. And it has to start at the highest level. And the highest level is our relationship to God, bringing it down in this new way. And when it changes us, you know, if you really know that God is your Divine Mother, and there's nothing you can do to separate yourself from her ever, and there's nothing you can do that will ever change the unconditional nature of her love, think of the comfort that brings you. I mean, that's the yogic principle of bliss. It's not that you're happy all the time, but you know, well, the way I love to say it, if it isn't the happy ending, it's not the ending yet. Because the story has a happy ending. And so if we haven't gotten there yet, that just means we have another chapter. But there's Delusion is big, but it's less than infinity. And therefore, it will end, and infinity will take over. And that's where we're going. All right. I think that's all I have to say, unless there's something else. All right. God bless you.